Good evening. K2RIW here. At this time, Mel, K2KEY, and Dick, K2RIW, begin the TechNet. Person signs into the TechNet, they've got a question or a comment by giving us your call letters, your name, and a confirming yes, which says you do have a question or a comment for the net. Do we have any check-ins this time? Please give me your call letters and name right now.
This is KC2QYW-BUK, Eugene. Everything is smooth. None. W2WK.
And QGOT, Howard, no.
And W2OSR, yes. Good evening, all. This is K2KEY. KC2FDD, Steve, no questions.
WS2N, Paul, no questions.
Okay.
2BDD, no.
Okay, so far we got K32QIW, I think it is. Eugene, N2GOT, Howard, and the, we got Secretary Bob, W2RSR. I think, Bob, did you say yes or no?
I said yes, Dick.
Thought so. Okay. You and QIW may be the first one. Steve, MVP, and some guy named Mel. Okay. Anyone else to check in with a, check, a question or a comment, please give us your call letter's name and that yes right now.
KB2BDV, Laura, no.
W2GOD, Steve, no questions.
KB2L2N, Walt, Benson Earth, no questions, yeah, thank you.
Just wait till we really get rolling, Walt. You'll get a question. Okay, we got Laura, Steve, and Walt in that pass. One last pass. Anyone else, if you're checking with questions or comments, give me a call letter's name and a yes right now. Okay, I think we've got all those who have questions. KC2QIW, I think it is. I should know your name. Please tell me your name again and proceed with your questions, sir. My name is Dick.
Yeah, hi, Dick. I'm the net. Name here is Joe, KC2QIW. And the name here is Joe. Okay, quick question. All right, my question is, I'm using the HF radio, right? I have an 899 antenna on there for now. You know, like it works on 10 meters and 15 meters. My question is, the G5RV. My question is, I want to use the G5RV, but the homie man said with the built-in antenna tuner, it's not recommended for normal wire. So now I'm a little confused now. Do they have a shorter one, I guess? Back to the net.
I think I see what you're asking, Joe. A G5RV is a kind of a dipole-like antenna. What Lou Varney did was to come up with an interesting technique of a slightly shorter than normal 80-meter dipole. I think it's slightly off-center fed, and it's got a slightly unusual method of connecting feed lines to it, so it gives you a pretty good impedance match on all of the major ham bands. The one complaint that some people have is that it does display a reasonably high standing wave ratio on 10 meters. So on 10 meters, it's a little bit more difficult to use. A good antenna tuner has very little trouble correcting that problem. However, the amount of antenna tuning correction required is sufficient that you sometimes run out of range with some antenna tuners. The automatic antenna tuners, what they really do is they are kind of a network analyzer, a poor man's network analyzer. It's a fancy way of saying it just doesn't measure how much reflective power you're getting from the antenna, and that's directly proportional to standing wave ratio, but it measures the phase angle. By measuring the phase angle with your automatic antenna tuner, it basically tells the antenna tuner which way to go in order to do the correction. It's a little bit like a person who's sight impaired and he's walking up a hill he can feel which way is up the hill because of the tilt on his feet, if you know what I mean. Well, an automatic antenna tuner, by measuring the phase, it knows which way is uphill. And every antenna tuner cannot cover the whole Smith chart. In other words, if you take all possible impedances that any antenna could ever have, in theory, you could represent them on a Smith chart. The Smith chart gives you all possible resistances from 0 ohms all the way up to infinity in ohms, and all the way from very capacitive to very inductive. So the Smith chart covers everything. Well, every antenna tuner will not give you the whole Smith chart. It gives you some portion of the Smith chart. And if your particular antenna happens to be in the dead zone, so to speak, where your antenna tuner can't go there, even though your antenna tuner is measuring phase and it knows which way to go, it can't get there. It gets stuck. It gets stuck into a do loop, so to speak, and it never comes up with an answer. The usual answer to that, though, is that as you add an extra length of cable, in other words, the 50-ohm cable that comes into the shack, which is the bottom end of the G5RV, if you add another eighth wavelength or another quarter wavelength of cable, that rotates the whole Smith chart as far as your antenna is concerned. And if you're a little bit lucky, the portion of the Smith chart that your antenna tuner could not cover in the past now has been moved into the good zone. You've moved from the dead zone to the good zone. And all of a sudden, your antenna tuner will work again. So people come up with opinions saying that the G5RV is not going to make it with an antenna tuner. That's sort of true in some circumstances. If the guy is smart enough, if he has the extra length of cable, I think 97% of the time, your antenna tuner will work with a G5RV. There's nothing wrong with the G5RV compared to other antennas. Just that it's a more troublesome antenna on 10 meters in the way most guys build it. The fact that it's shorter or longer than resonant compared to other kinds of HF antennas, that's not really the factor. That's the way I see it. Now, I'm not an HF person. I'm a VHF person that tries to give people on HF answers. The good news of that is that every kind of impedance matching in the microwave world can happen in the HF world. So physics is physics. The answer usually works. But you take somebody who's died in the wool in HF, and he talks to those people on a daily basis, he knows a little bit more about what's going on. That's Mel. And Mel, tell us what you think about antenna tuning, automatic, and G5RV antennas. K2KEY, K2LIW in the TechNet.
K2J with a comment.
JJ, you recognize. Mel first. Go ahead.
Hey, good evening, all again. This is KTKEY. Well, as far as G5RVs, I've tried them out. I had one that somebody gave me that they took it down because they weren't happy for a number of reasons. And the problem that they basically came about with the G5RV, because originally at Barney, when a head had laid it out, he laid it out with 450-ohm feeders directly into a balanced input of the tuner. Now, what they have done, of course, they have sold a lot of the G5RVs, in fact, all of them, where they hang a small ballum at the end of the length of a 450-ohm ladder line. And that's where I think a number of the problems have begun, because now they take that point, add a piece of 52-ohm cable to it, then go into a regular tuner. Now, these auto tuners, they work well, mostly if you do locate them up there towards the antenna point. Further down the line with the G5RV, at the end of that length of 450-ohm line, and then that ballum, if you locate at that point, yes, I've seen quite a number of problems. I never really spotted it exactly. But what's the best way to go? If you could go to a pure G5RV and have the right tuner stick, it can work quite well. I noticed that, yes, I did notice on many of the bands that there are some spots of the band, for some reason you get all of a sudden a sudden jump in the reactance. In other words, it's not a subtle change, it's a big change in the reactance at certain parts, you know, like, for instance, They'd be very good for a good part of, like, for instance, 40 meter CW band, up until somewhere you get up there into the phone band, and all of a sudden there's a tremendous jump in the act, and Dick said, whoops, that's just that.
Background, yeah, I don't know what happened.
Let me just take a look what that noise was there.
Yeah, that sounded like a snap, like a sudden short circuit occurred or something. I'm going to turn it over to K2, I think it's JEJ or JJ, in a second. I wouldn't be afraid of using an automatic antenna tuner with a G5RB. At worst, the system will go into a hang-up mode and will never come to a solution. You'll hear the gears grinding over and over again, so to speak. And maybe it's got a what they call a watchdog timer in there, where after a certain length of time, if it doesn't come to a solution, it turns itself off. But with rare exception, damage does not occur. I mean, the thing's not going to blow up just because it can't come to a solution. I think it was K2JJ or K2JEJ. Please correct my call letters and your name, sir, and then proceed with your comment on the subject. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, Dick, it's K2EJ. Eric, you remember me. And Mel actually covered some of it. I just wanted to point out a couple of things, is that, number one, automatic antenna tuners and built-into radios. Okay, one thing that people forget, they're not continuously variable devices. Most of them do not have a continuous L in the form of a roller or a continuous inductor. And many of them, believe it or not, don't even have an output coupling capacitor that's variable and hooked up to a motor. Some of them do, some of them don't. But most, if you look at the specs on most of the built-in tuners, they cover a range of that runs anywhere from 3-to-1 to 6-to-1 to 9-to-1, not much more. There are a couple of manufacturers that make infinitely variable automatic tuners, and they're generally designed to hook up to a single wire. You know, an end-fed antenna is their philosophy. But the other thing about the G5RV, which many people forget about, is that the little section of ladder line between the baron and the dipole, what you think of as dipole itself, that's active. And many people don't take a lot of care as to how they place it. And just interestingly enough, at the station we've got a G5RV, and my buddy was down there with his vector network analyzer. We were doing some work on our antenna and feed line system. We hooked it up to that just for the heck of it. And I never realized how bumpy G5RV is. It's got an interesting pattern across the various bands. Back to you, Dick. K2RIWK2J.
Okay, I think part of what you're saying, Eric, is that some of the modern antenna tuners, since they don't have a real roll adapter and a real large transmitter-rated variable capacitor in the thing, they don't have as much tuning range as you'd like. I'm reinterpreting that as saying that it doesn't cover as high a percentage of the Smith chart as I would like. However, I'd like to believe that even the usual embodiment of a G5RV, even if the person didn't do a proper job on recognizing the active versus inactive portions of the transmission line, but a smart enough guy would still be able to choose the right length of cable that he adds in the shack to his feed line, such that he rotates the Smith chart with reference to his antenna, so that now his particular antenna tuner will cover the particular band he's interested in. He may have to add an eighth wavelength of cable when he's on 10 meters and take it back out when he's on 40 meters. But don't you think a smart guy would be able to find a solution with that technique, such that he would be able to use his antenna tuner if he's smart enough on each one of the bands of the G5RV if he wants to? What do you think about that possible approach, Eric? KE2EJ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
No, absolutely, Dick. You know, there's no situation where that you haven't been able to adjust either the length of the feed line or the length of the element, depending upon what frequency you want. I'm just talking about the lazy guy that wants to throw the thing up out of the bag, not cut it, and work every square inch of the band and expect to be happy. You know, the smart, intelligent person will go through the various different adjustments you can make to your physical setup to bring things into into a range in which the automatic tune is more manual. By the way, the reason why the range is limited is they use fixed inductors and relays. And, you know, it's done in steps. And they try to do combinations of variable capacitors and different combinations of inductors depending upon how the computer is, you know, whoever wrote the software and what his philosophy of finding where the maximum and minimum currents are. So, you know, it depends on the manufacturer and so on and so forth. And a good old MFJ tuner can about weeks, but that's funny. When we were up at the World Trade Center, we tried to load the entire mast up on 80 meters, and we could just about do it. It was really funny. But it took a tuner that was, you know, had real variable inductance, because I don't think most of the energy was in the tuner, but it was just a fun experiment anyway.
Andy recognized that. Whoa, go back here a minute there, Eric. You just dropped a bomb on me. I mean, you take a 1,300-foot-high building called New York City World Trade Center Building Number 1. You got this 330-foot mast sticking out of the top of it with a zillion broadcast antennas on it. And along comes a guy named Eric who loads the whole damn mast on the 80-meter band and uses it for 80-meter ham radio. Run that by again and tell me what it felt like when you squeeze the mic on that rig and you talk through that so-called antenna, the biggest mass on planet Earth almost. What does it sound like? What does the DX sound like? How many watts did you put into it? Give us a couple of more words on that one, Eric. Wow. KE2EJ, K2LIW.
Hi, K2RIW, K2J. Hey, it wasn't me. It was somebody else that is no longer with us. But I was there. And, the guys had been, you know, oh, well, how about loading this thing up? Because the mast itself has a couple of anchor points which is connected to the building. And one of the other guys was finding a nice place to make a contact to it and using a TDR that he had and some other things, and I don't know the whole story, but the end result was they essentially tried to load into it and managed to do it. There's just so much noise in that building. I'm sure, you know, some of the reports that we got from some people who were listening fairly far away was interesting, but the building is so darn noisy, it's hard to hear anything there.
Okay, from what I'm hearing, you would have needed the world's best noise blanker. Before I turn it over to Andy, not yet Andy, Eric, I got one other question for you. If a person is a little bit too quick, doesn't bother worrying about the exact impedance, whether or not the impedance falls into the good chart, the good portion of the Smith chart where your antenna tuner can work. Assuming the worst case, your antenna tuner cannot hack it, and it's an automatic antenna tuner, and it's sitting there cycling. What happens? Does anything bad happen? Do you wear out the relays? Does the thing go tilt? Can damage occur? If a guy just dumbly uses an automatic antenna tuner in the worst case, is that system self-protecting, Eric? KE2EJ, K2LIW?
No, it depends. If you're talking about an antenna tuner that's an integral part of a radio, like a Yaesu or an ICOM, first of all, realize that they don't put full power into it when they go hunting for where the, you know, the best impedance match is. That's the first thing. So, you know, you can put a short on the end of it, and the thing is just going to be happy and say, oh, I'm going to try and load this to zero ohms. And at some point, the computer says, you know, I've had enough, I quit, and it just stops. If you're talking about some of these antenna tuners that are external to your radio, and, you know, it has this thing, I believe, and don't quote me because I have not taken any of them apart or looked at the schematics, but from what I've heard from some other people, is they're pretty smart about it. But they do warn you not to put several hundred watts in it while you're trying to make a tune. A lot of them have a cable that runs between the current modern-day radios, and they talk to each other, and it forces the radio to go into a tune mode, which drops the power. Does that answer your question?
Yes, it does. So, as long as you're not pouring a kilowatt through the antenna tuner, which would be very foolish, while it's doing its search, yes, you could probably do damage, but you cut it back to, I'm going to pick a number, 10 watts of tune mode, and you let it try to find a solution, I think you cannot do any damage. See what Andy's got to say about this. I bet you worked with some antenna, automatic antenna tuners on some of the rigs you've been fixing over the years, Andy. So the A2CDL, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Okay, fine. And Eric, there's a spot, I'm meeting up with Eric, there's a spot we caused, two cars to be. It sounds like it's pretty close. I worked on quite a few, and I just, from what I've seen, is that, of course, the antenna tuner will look for a certain VSWR range to tune into. And if it doesn't find it, it'll just keep cycling. At least one of the ones that I worked on, one of the Kenwoods, it's, like Eric said, it uses six inductors that are tapped at different locations with using relays. So by tapping the coil to, and it's either a Pi or an L network, whatever network they use, of course, by tapping the coil and then using the relay to short out turns, you could specify a certain inductance given the capacitance range that's in parallel to make the Pi network configuration. And mostly, that's what makes the tuners pretty quick. Because if you had a roller inductor, that thing would have to rev up pretty quick to find its actual light delphi ratio at the time. And most antenna tuners are quicker than that because all you do is, as soon as you change the band, it knows which relay to actuate, which then obviously produces the right tap on the coil, and then it searches. Given the power going into it, it sees what VSWR it's looking into, and usually it's adjusted for a 2-to-1 ratio, or so around there. You know, give plus or minus a few volts or so, and when it finds. When it finds the right VSWR that it's looking for, it says stop, and it stops right there. The relays do go intermittent occasionally. Sometimes the contact is burnishing, and if the relay stops working completely, then he won't have the right tap on the coil, and obviously it won't be resident on that particular band, and it'll just keep searching and searching, and it'll never stop. And I've seen that before, too. So, just wanted to make that comment about it. Stick back to you, the PC studio.
K2K, water comments.
And I can answer that, too. Okay, yep. We got Mel and Eric in that order, but still, I got a subsequent question for Andy on this exact subject. I'm of the opinion, Andy, this is what I'd like you to confirm or deny. I'm of the opinion that if Joe, KT2QIW, who asked the original question, is smart enough to make sure that his rig is running, let's say, 10 watts in the tune mode while he's using an automatic antenna tuner, and he's going into any old ratty antenna, even the worst case G5RV, I'd like to believe it's a 10-watt tune mode, even though it may go cycling for a long period of time, no real damage can occur, that he shouldn't be afraid of the combination of automatic antenna tuner and G5RV. He's got some of his buddies on the band saying, don't do that, terrible things are going to happen, you're going to blow up your rig, and I think that's hogwash. I think if he's making sure he's at the 10-watt level in tune, I think he can't get into any trouble. The worst that will happen is it'll cycle, and he says, yes, I've got to do something to help the system out. That's my opinion. Let's see if you agree or disagree with that, Andy.
The A2CDL, K2LIW on the TechNet. Yeah, exactly. You're not going to hurt anything. And like Eric said, it usually it goes into a low power mode. You don't have to transmit 100 watts to get your antenna tuner to to tune in, into the right impedance of whatever it's looking into. So I've never seen any damage done by that. And if I was in somebody else's shoes, not knowing what kind of antenna I have, not knowing about the antenna tuner, I would just tune it and see what happens. If there's a problem, if it sees SWR that's going to be fairly high and it's out of the range of the calibration of the antenna tuner, it'll just either keep cycling or it'll just stop. Most of the time it'll just keep cycling and you'll say that, it's not finding the resonance that I'm looking for. And then you could, of course, shut down the transmitter and then do some investigation to find out why your SWR is that high. It really shouldn't be that high in the first place. So, not to worry. That's my opinion. Back to you.
Beautiful. Glad you confirmed that, Andy. Let's see what Mel and Eric have got to say in that order. Mel, K2KEY, go right ahead.
Okay, this is K2KEY. All right, now, experience with it. I have the rig that have the built-in antenna tuner. And, of course, a good few extra bucks to, buy the rig with that additional piece added on. The reason I did it, really, was more of a curiosity than anything else. I bought the Deluxe radio, figuring that, oh boy, I just got everything, all the bells and whistles at the time. I want to see really what it's capable. Both transmitter, receiver, going through all kinds of modes and all. And I see if I really get something real reactive, it just holds back the power. And then I went ahead and I built, which I spent a heck of a lot of money, also to do an experiment on the WHCR easy tuner system. You may have seen it was featured in QXT a few years ago, 2002. We ran a couple of series articles on an automatic, a super duper automatic antenna tuner, the last word in antenna tuner. And he did a pretty good job of it, of the design and all. The problem was he went to a fixed coil with a rotary switch, rather than a rotary inductor type of device. Controlled variables have servo motors on it, and he has a control motor assembly just to flip the switch to a number of taps on the coil. So I spoke to him, and I said, well, what about putting a rotary inductor in place of it? He said, well, if you could work out the mechanics and the software of it, he said, I said, well, I think I can do it because I can more or less link it to what you've done already. And so I went ahead and I put that together, and I did experiments again to see what happens with different reactive flows. And the answer is that with this type of software, where you add this tuner where you can put the full power, so you can run to a kilowatt with it, and what it'll do, besides, it'll hunt after a while, it just comes up with an error. It just goes 5 times, it'll check. That was basically what he wrote into the software. It would, in other words, test the system, in a way, to a number of different possibilities. And Jimmy, the guy who designed it, he says, otherwise the motors are going to drive you crazy. That's going back and forth with this old servo motor. And that's what happens. The servo motors will continuously hunt. So after 5 independent hunts with each time going to reset, it then stops and tells you that it blinks the light. It's supposed to be an error light, Dick. But even the automatics basically are working on the same situation, except that they, when ones that are incorporated into the rig, just pull back the power and then stop, Dick, over.
WB2HWW with a question.
Okay, how we recognize, but Eric is first. Go ahead with your comment, Eric.
Two things. One is the way the automatic tuners work that are laid out with really the question. They do something called a fuse source.
a couple of different algorithms that they use as, there's a couple of different algorithms that they use to quickly find where the best impedance match is. It starts off really coarse and gets finer and finer and finer. The other thing is that in today's solid-state radios, there's a current fold back on the bias circuit, so as the SWR gets higher and the transistor starts to draw more current, the bias folds back, it reduces the output. So even if you put a short of course, you're not going to fly the nice 50-hour or 75-hour broadband transistor to the output of the radio. So if we were going to go back to the old days, and we had like, 500Zs, 4-1000, we just peek in a little hole, see if our plates are glowing bright cherry red, look at the grid current and make sure we're not melting it, and go from there. Keep your eyes up, you can't do
that. Thank you, Eric. Yeah, back in the old days with tubes and a rig like a DX100 Heathkit or some of these other Collins rigs or whatever, you had a real large tuning range of your Pi network, tuning and loading, and even a 10 to 1 or a 20 to 1 standing wave ratio was easy. We all want these no-tune compact rigs, and therefore we've created these problems. But still, I don't think we should be that gun-shy of various combinations. You're always going to find some old grandmother of a ham radio operator who says, no, you can't do that. Well, the guy who says it can't be done should get out of the way of the guy who wants to go do it, who's capable of doing it. So as long as you get a little bit of smart and you do it in a conservative manner, like tuning it to 10 watt level, I think you can't get in trouble. Now, Howie's got a further question on this. Go right ahead, Howie.
And the question that I have, Dick, which is a better tuner? The electronic ones, like the smart tuners, are all solid state, or one with servo motors? I would assume that if I had the money, I would rather have something like what Mel is talking about. I'd like to hear from the group, which is a better tuner?
Well, the word better is almost like saying, is a blonde better than a brunette? There's a lot of variables involved here. I guarantee the roll inductor and the great big transmitting rated 500 picofarad air variable capacitor, that kind of a combination for an antenna tuner, with huge range to it, and servo motors feeding it. That's going to match anything. That's the good news. But that's a very voluminous thing. It's a very expensive thing. It takes somebody like Mel and his scientific background to build a thing like that. The market for such a thing is so small that nobody is building it. And if they did, the price would be very high. So it's without a doubt a better tuner. But how many guys can afford it? How many guys are willing to dedicate that much room to it? That's my first guess as to what's going on. Mel, which do you think is the best kind of tuner to answer Howie's question? K2KEY, K2RIW on the deck net.
Hey, this is K2KEY. Well, I'll give you an answer. With the easy tuner system and the rotary inductor and those fancy capacitors I put in there that cost the arm and the leg, I could say this thing really get to really add up, including the bird dual inline fall reflection system. In other words, bird makes a dual inline system that you can mount into the tuner so that you can read both forward and reflective power simultaneously, or flip it, switch over without doing any kind of manipulation of the plug. So adding that in, plus the capacitors in there that were, each capacitor in there ran from around 35 mics to 500. And the rotary inductor in there, was it better? Well, let me put it this way. I was able to substantiate that I could get 3-to-1 ohm load with an SWR of 16-to-1, and like for instance on 160 meters, I mean that's only that's a loss of approximately 25%. On let's see,
at, let's see, what else did I do? I mean, I'm giving you a really extreme, but I definitely was able to go to load from 3.1 ohms to about 900 ohms. Yes, to 900 ohms, Vic, and with SWRs on different bands as high as 16 to 1, Vic, with this type of system. But it, I could say it is a, if you take a look at this thing, it is a bit of a monster to put together and to work, get it working, but I don't think you're going to beat it as a tuner because of what Holly just said, that that system to use servo motors seems to be the ideal way to go over.
I just ran the mathematics of what you just gave us, Mel. A 3.1 ohm pure resistive load on a 50 ohm system is a 16.1 standing wave ratio. A 900 ohm load, you could also measure that with a 50 ohm system. That's an 18 to 1 standing wave ratio. Man, you had antenna tuning range. Wow. That's the good news. Give us a rough guess, Mel. How many pounds and how many cubic feet and how many dollars? In that order, how many pounds, how many cubic feet was that K2KEY tune everything monster? Back to you, Mel.
Okay, if you really want to see it, you know, in person, then you go to get the book out here. Let me get the dates out here. I got it somewhere marked out. I was looking for it. Oh, here it is. I know I have it someplace now. 2002 QSP, May 2002 of QSP. It's the color, it's featured on the cover. The size of it goes in a 19-inch cabinet. It's a 19-inch rack-mounted cabinet. And weight-wise, wound up at about, I'd say, 30 pounds, 35 pounds, you know, with everything. I jammed everything into the cabinet for us to get a power supply in it, lights it up, and all kinds of very nice indicators and all. In fact, I made it even a little fancier than his that you'll see on the cover there. So if you look at WACR Easy Tuna. And the one I have, I use a vacuum variable in it, and so that added to the cost considerably. The total cost wound up at, I think, about, close your ears, I'm telling you, my wife's looking at me, and she's shaking her head. It wound up, I think, close to about $1,400.
That's a better antenna tuner. But let's face it, that's a Cadillac. And so now we all, you know, depending on how much of a scientist you are, depending on how experienced you are with your hobby, you've got to decide that you're either willing to make that big investment in an antenna tuner that can cover every possible situation, or the other solution is to use a, by the way, an 18-pound antenna tuner, if I heard correctly, as opposed to our modern-day rigs are around 5 or 10 pounds, you can see this is quite an investment in dollars, volume, and so on, as opposed to being a little bit more persnickety in the way you build and tune your antennas, so you don't need such heroic techniques in order to handle the antenna tuner situation. You pay your money, you take your choice. Okay. Alrighty, Joe, I'm going to pass it back to you briefly. If you don't get through the little bit of interference that we're hearing right now, I'll then turn it over to Bob, because Bob's got a nice strong signal, and I know that he'll get through. Joe, if you have any further comments?
Okay, Dick, W2OSR. He'll let me know when I'll arrive from the hearing. Alright. Let me give it back to you, because I want to make sure you can hear me.
Oh, you're coming through loud and clear, Bob. You got a nice, strong signal. Have fun. Go right at it. Have at it, Bob.
Now, the new radio 150 watts output kind of works, doesn't it? Okay. At any rate, I'm playing around with an antenna design for 17 and 12 meters, and I've been doing some modeling on it. Got something that looks like it'll be reasonably good, but I ran into a curious thing when I played around with what height am I going to mount this thing at. To give you an idea, the basic idea is it looks like a 17-meter dipole
with two wires parallel to the main wire, one on each side of it, at about 6 inches. Basically a sleeve sleeve configuration. Now, if I set this up at 20 feet, in order to balance out the fact that it's going to be a little obstructive, I had to add immediately after the connection to the balance, a couple of capacitors. So at the 20-foot level, the capacitors that we used to make a tune were 200 picofarads each. If I raised it up to 30 feet, those two capacitors dropped down to 100 picofarads. And I had to, you know, manipulate the length of the wires a little bit to get it back where I wanted it. So that's just that change in capacitors, depending on height, is what kind of threw me over.
Okay, John, good question. And you've got an implied question there, too, which I'm going to answer at the same time, Bob. But what's really going on here is that your antenna, when it sees the ground reverb, another signal, another signal reflected back to the antenna, that other signal reflected from the ground has a certain phase angle to it, depending on a certain magnitude, depending on the ground reflection and how far away it was. And therefore, it shifts the resonance of the antenna higher or lower, and you can bring it back into resonance either by using antenna tuner or by adding capacitance or inductance at the right place, top hat capacitors, loading coils, whatever. There's a million ways you can get it back into resonance. All transmitting antennas, you resonate them first, you radiate second. And the reason why you resonate them is that one of the things that's not made clear in any of the books that we own is that radiation is hard. Radiation does not come easy. What you've got to do is anticipate the fact that the signal that goes on to anything you and I call antenna, that signal has to bounce back and forth on that so-called antenna about 30 times before it's finally radiated into space. What you and I call resonance really is making sure that those 30 bounces all stay in phase with each other. That's what resonance really is, making sure all the 30 bounces stay in phase. If your antenna is a little bit too short, so if the bounces start falling ahead of being in step, we call that leading phase, and we say the antenna is acting capacitive. When the antenna is a little bit too long, for instance, and they start falling out of phase by lagging in phase, we say the antenna acts inductive. That's what we all know what the reactance of an antenna is. We all know about that bathtub curve you get when you sweep the antenna and you measure the standing wave ratio. Well, just measuring the standing wave ratio is just telling you the magnitude of the visual, the magnitude of the reflection coefficient. If you look at the phase angle and you find out if it's a capacitor or inductive, and that's what a network analyzer does for you automatically, you're getting the one step more information. So whether you have to add capacitance, inductance, or whatever to your antenna to bring it back into resonance, and as long as you're using low-loss components, you're still going to get darn close to 100% efficiency out of the antenna. So if you're about to ask the question, which is better, the 200 picofarad at 20 feet or the 100 picofarad at 30 feet, both are going to have, as an antenna, as a resonating, radiating structure, they're both going to have nearly 100% efficiency. By that I mean you put 100 watts into it, and 100 watts will leave that wire, be radiated somewhere into the nearby space, and not heat up the wire. However, how much of it is heating up the ground, and what's your vertical angle of radiation going to be, and are you looking for a near vertical incident sky wave, you know, close QSO type contact where you want to talk to your buddy in New Jersey or Pennsylvania, or are you looking for the higher altitude of the antenna where you get the lower angle of radiation and you're going to get the further DX and you're going to talk to your buddy in London and Australia and so on? That's the real thing that's happening as a function of altitude. So I think your implied question is, Bob, is which is better? They're both equally as good, depending on what you're looking to do. Altitude tells you what you're intending the antenna to do. You're smart enough to make anything resonate. And once it resonates, all power you put into the antenna will leave the antenna by going into at least nearby space. The reason I use the word nearby space is that if your antenna is close to the ground, some of it gets coupled into the earth and it gets wasted. That problem is really bad with a vertical ground plane antenna which is mounted right on the surface, and you don't have enough ground plane radio. Your dipole is nowhere near that bad. 20 or 30 feet up, I don't think you can make a dipole with ground absorption any worse than 80% efficiency. So you've got the freedom, Bob, to make that antenna any way you want. Your biggest choice is going to be what altitude is the right altitude for your kind of desired operation. And you're kind of a guy that's going to sometimes want to talk to your nearby buddies in Pennsylvania, and you want a low antenna. You're going to sometimes talk to your DX buddies in South Africa, and you want a high antenna. And the Bob I know has got the resources to build two antennas, one high and one low, one with the 100 picofarad and one with the 200 picofarad. And he's got a selecting switch in the shack. He chooses the right antenna for the right operation, and now he's got it all. Boy, do we have a secretary. W2OSR, K2LIW on the TechNet.
You got me laughing here. I wish I had the real estate for that. probably going to be closer to the 20-foot height, only because of what I've got here where I can hang them. And interesting enough, in modeling it, the antenna pad here is a little bit lower angle of radiation, 10 feet more up, but not significantly enough to make that big a difference. I think when I model it, you're going to have about half an S unit difference between the two different heights in terms of signal strength at any particular different angle. So, it's nice that it's pretty broad in terms of the elevation pattern. So that part was good. The antenna models out as having, depending on frequency, upwards of 90 feet gain over isotropic, pretty good. So putting the power where I want it.
Bob, on your last transmission, your audio was very good, very clean, but half the volume I think it should be. Either you're not talking as close to the mic as you were in the beginning, or something changed a little bit there, so you could use a little bit more audio. But what's stopping you from mounting the antenna high, Bob? Are you saying you don't have enough land or you don't have a high enough tree? I think you should have a high antenna and a low antenna, so you've got both kinds of operation. What do you think stopping you? And if we come over to your property with a good bow and arrow set up and we can string wires into your tallest trees, can't we get that antenna up high if that's what you wanted? Back to you, Bob.
Well, Dick, if you try to use the bow and arrow, you'll be stringing it over the power line. I have virtually no trees on the property. I've got two nice cherry trees out in front of the house that are about to fall. They're really not going to do much for me. The other factor that we haven't factored in here is XYL tolerance.
Yeah, but a piece of wire, Bob, even a sleeve dipole, and by the way, where you've got parallel wires, what you're really doing when you put a couple of wires parallel to each other, if it's the antenna itself that you're paralleling, you're fooling the RF into thinking that it's a large diameter piece of tubing. And that works very well, by the way. It gives you a little bit lower Q and a little bit broader visual bandwidth. It's one of many techniques for doing it. Some people call that a sleeve, but if you really use the vocabulary correctly, a sleeve-fed dipole literally has a shielded section and a radiating section of what you and I would call the dipole. And sometimes the sleeves are near the center of the dipole. Sometimes the sleeve is at one end because your feed line is coming out of one end of the dipole as opposed to off at right angles. You Google the word sleeve dipole or sleeve-fed dipole. You'd be amazed some of the nice antennas you'll find. Once again, Bob, your audio could be a little bit louder. I wonder if you have a volume control on that rig. W2OSR, K2LIW on the TechNet.
No, I don't have a volume control, Dick. I just got to remember to speak up. I start getting tired at the end of this. It's a little clean here. Actually, it probably is a better term for it would be a parasitic antenna. It's basically a dipole with some parasitic elements for 12 meters.
Okay. The latest issue of Antennas and Propagation Journal for the IEEE AP Society, and also an issue way back in December of 2006. December issue 2006, IEEE Antennas and Propagation Proceedings, had a beautiful dipole antenna. I'll admit that it was a 1,000 megacycle antenna built with printed circuit boards just to prove the process. But they made a dipole cover and active. Ordinarily, a dipole is it has a real trouble matching more than about 80% of the 80-meter band with 2-to-1 standing wave ratio. I forget what that is in percentage, but I guess it's a 20% or something like that of the frequency. And can you imagine making 100% coverage, a full octave and beyond, by using parasitic elements coupled together with a dipole? You can... It's interesting. I'm hearing the PL tone going up and down in the background. There are techniques of adding parasitic elements alongside of a dipole by which you can make it cover inactive. So broadbanding a dipole, that's another whole art and science in itself. I mean, the dipole was invented by Heinrich Hertz, I think, way back in 1860-something, 1870-something. Here we are 140 years later, reinventing the dipole. It's time we do it. There's nothing wrong with that. So there are great techniques for broadbanding a dipole, and that in itself is a very interesting experiment, because the main thing we amateurs can do as tinkerers is play with antennas. And you can have a grand old time with that. You open up the latest issue of Antenna Engineering Handbook, the fourth edition by Volakis. And it's an expensive book, but 1,200 pages, 45 chapters, but there's 5,000 kinds of antennas depicted in that book. The word antenna is not simple. And so, boy, can we experiment with that. None of us who are practical are going to build your own 80-to-10 meter sideband solid state rig. You take 2 weeks of your salary or 3 weeks of your salary and you buy the darn thing because it's a practical thing to do, because it would take you 2 years to build that and you would own it for the rest of your life. You'd never be able to trade it in. Whereas you buy a respected brand name of rig from Southeast Asia, and if you don't like the way the front panel is arranged, 6 months later you can sell it and get a good percentage of your money back if it's a respected brand name that people like. It's sort of an investment. So we don't build our rigs anymore, we buy them. But we can build our antennas. Tinker with antennas, and there's no end to what you can do with it. And if you think the last word has been written about antennas, you're about as foolish as that guy in 1895 who said, I'm taking over the patent office in the United States, but I'm probably not going to have very much work to do because everything that possibly can be patented has already been patented. Why was he wrong? Well, the same sort of situation happens with antennas. If you think you've heard the end of the story with antennas, don't you believe it. I'm guaranteeing somebody out there has got a couple of comments on all of this. Give us your call letters right now. KQLAW on the TechNet. How about that? I can't believe I said the last word on that one. Hey, Mel, you got to give us a couple of words on this one. Do you think there's a couple of more things that we can invent on antennas, like antennas that are small in size, low in frequency, like 80 meters, and can be steered in azimuth and elevation and polarization, and the hold-on antenna is aimed and is located in the shack with you, and if you decide to it, you don't have to use it just for receiving. You can transmit with it, and you can compare it to a full 300-and-some-odd-foot-long loop antenna on 80 meters, 40 feet in the air in the backyard, and you find out the loop inside the house works better. Do you think there's a little bit more to be discovered on antennas, Mel? Here's a man who's doing it. KQKEY, KQRIW on the TechNet.
Roger, this is KQKEY. Well, Dick, you know, I guess if somebody would have said this to me a couple of years ago, on 75 meters, I would have said, oh boy, here's another one. But been there and did it. So the other night, in fact, Friday night, I was on, Wednesday night. I was on 75 meters, and somebody I haven't talked to in a long time from New Jersey, Dan, our friend Dan, in fact, he joined us today even on the 10-meter net, and he is in New Jersey, and the noise level and his signal were just very marginal. Couldn't hear him on at all. I could hear somebody in on there with the full-wave loop, that's 272 feet of wire. 45 feet up in the air, but the noise level was just a little too much. So I said, okay, here's a good test of the loop. I, the inside the receiving loop, I put the headphones on, have it connected to the 7584 Collins receiver. And I was just moved it onto him, peaked it, tilted a little bit here and there, and was able to get perfect copy. I won't say a very signal-wise, he wasn't that strong. I mean, he was basically maybe at the most, if I want to, you know, rely on the FD to readings, which I, well, on the Collins 8-4, I'm a little bit generous saying to read FD. The other, a lot of other receivers, I think we've gone through this about FD a few weeks ago. But if I want to say that he was moving the F meter up to, say, F3, and the noise level on the regular loop was at least close to that. So the difference is, with the receiving loop, I was amazed that I made perfect copy on him. Nulled out the noise just about to zero, brought his signal up and everything like that. I was quite amazed that I was able to hold for 1 hour perfect copy with the solid stand in New Jersey. So it attests that you say, how could this be that the thing that's 12 feet in square, compared again, I always say this over and over again, to 272 feet of wire strung up from four supports, 45 feet up with this kind of location, how could that possibly be a computer at all? And yet, I can say again, it just surprises me every time, Dick. It's just hard to really, no matter how many times we discuss it, really to grasp what is going on here, Dick. Over.
Yeah, pity poor Mel. Every time he goes on 80 meters and he tells people the story about his hands-on real experience over the last couple of years, a high percentage of the people who hear the story directly from his mouth, the president of the guy who, the president of the Kings County Radio Club, and anyone is talking about some guy off the street here, we're talking about a guy who's been in ham radio since 1956, I think it is, or 1955, and he's been around a while, he's been around the clock, he's got a track record. So here he is, a guy telling the honest story about how well that loop antenna works in his shack versus the great big thing out in the backyard, and they think he's crazy. They think he's making up the story. They think he's testing their credibility. He's doing none of the above. And I got a partial explanation for what's going on here. If you get a brand new rig, or if you get your ordinary 80 to 10 meter receiver, you connect it to a full 40 meter dipole or an 80 meter dipole that's up in the trees in the backyard, and you're looking at the signals on the S meter and you're tuning across the band, and you know what the band should sound like. Someday you do an experiment. You disconnect the cable in the back end of the rig, and you plug in a random length of wire. You plug it into the center conductor, and maybe that's a clip lead that's 3 feet long. And you plug it into the center conductor of the UHF connector on the back end of the rig, and you go tuning across the band. And you realize the people you're listening to sound almost the same. The S meter doesn't move as much, but what you hear out of the loudspeaker is almost the same. And you wonder, what in the world is going on here? And let me explain this one to you. First of all, a receiver is very forgiving. In other words, in the case of a transmitter, you will, with rare exception, bring the standing wave ratio down to 2 to 1 or 1.5 to 1 or better to keep the transmitter happy, to give it full power output without folding back, going into the self-protect mode, and to really radiate that signal. You're going to make a rip.